Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. The bail reform movement has been around for decades, but it's taking on new life as proposals are being introduced in a growing number of states. Ohio is one of the latest states to consider the issue in the form of House Bill 439. Supporters say bail reform will lead to fewer defendants being held in jail simply because they can't afford to pay. Critics say the idea is good, but as the movement has grown, there have been problems associated with it. We'll talk with American Bail Coalition Executive Director Jeff Clayton and CEO of the Pretrial Justice Institute, Charisse Burdine. Joining me first is State Representative Jonathan Deaver. He represents Ohio's 28th House District, which includes the northern suburbs of Hamilton County, and he's one of the lawmakers who proposed House Bill 439. Good afternoon, Representative Deaver. Thank you for joining us.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
Now, what's the current system in Ohio? How's bail set under Ohio's current rules?
Currently, we have a pretty strict bail schedule. So essentially, when an individual is charged with a crime, there's a piece of paper and it has a schedule on it. It says this is the crime and here's the bail for that initial part. So you have to remember there's two pieces to bail. There's the first part, where you don't see a judge, meaning that the officer takes you into custody, processes you at the local jail, and they set a bail at that point based on that bail schedule. And then there's also the follow-up part where you see a judge, and then the judge can make an additional decision.
So what will your bill do to change things?
Well, what we're trying to do is get away from monetary bail being a strict schedule. So, when we introduced the bill, we drafted the bill so that we would have a good conversation about where and when we should have, or if at all we should have strict bail schedules, meaning that there's a charge and this is how much money it's going to cost you to get out of jail. And so the tenor of the language of the bill is to break these things into different sections. So you have the first 48 to 72 hours where an accused does not see a judge, and then also from the judge moving forward. And the idea being that we are going to go more towards a series of factors, with a risk assessment tool being among one of several factors. Also, the whether the defendant is likely to appear or not appear at court, and also the degree of the crime as it relates to other people. So whether there's a victim involved or whether they run a risk to harming others in society. So using more of a factor-based approach with some software and some real data based on that individual, their likelihood to appear to court again, and also the severity of the charge.
Yeah, one of the concerns of critics of bail reform is the risk assessment computer algorithm that's being used. They'll point to cases where the algorithm determined that someone was low risk, when in fact they were just the opposite and committed a violent crime after they were released on bail. How does your bill address that? How do you address that?
Sure. So instead of being strictly 100% only on a risk assessment tool, it becomes a variable, a factor. So it becomes one of many pieces of an overall decision-making process. So what we're really trying to do is get away from this, depending on how much money you have in your pocket determines whether you should get out. There's a lot of non-jailable offenses, just to take a prime example, where someone has never had any experience with the criminal justice system of any kind, whether it was a juvenile or an adult. You get pulled over for a traffic ticket, which is a minor misdemeanor, non-jailable offense. And there are people that do a couple of nights in jail waiting for a judge on a Monday morning over the course of a weekend. So those types of things, we really want to make sure people aren't sitting in jail for those types of offenses. The likelihood of them creating a risk of harm to others is very, very minimal. The likelihood of them showing up to court is extremely high. So the risk assessment tool becomes a variable. I think what people are afraid of is that their risk assessment tool becomes the only consideration and becomes 100% dispositive, and that's not what this legislation is trying to do.
So where does House Bill 439 stand at this point in the legislative process?
So we've had a couple of hearings. We introduced some draft language to get the conversation started. We've had some very productive interested party meetings with people who are on all sides of this particular issue, advocates for, advocates against, bail bondsmen, clerks of courts at the municipal and at the common pleas level, as well as attorneys who represent defendants or prosecute cases. And so we've had a couple of hearings, and we're looking to substitute the bill based on all that collective feedback in the next couple of weeks. So it's moving along in the normal course of the legislative process, and I'm hopeful that with this substitute bill, those concerns that people had initially will be alleviated.
Representative Deaver, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Yes, sir.
State Representative Jonathan Deaver, who represents Ohio's 28th House District. Joining me now, Executive Director of the American Bail Coalition, Jeff Clayton. Good afternoon, Jeff.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Good, thank you. And we are also going to have the CEO of the Pretrial Justice Institute, Charisse Burdeen, join us in just a moment here. But Jeff, let's start with you. The idea of bail reform sounds good. You create a fairer, more equitable system where someone isn't held in jail just because they can't afford to pay the bail. What is the problem as your organization sees it?
Well, we don't think the risk assessment process works. And I think the neighbor to the south of Ohio has proven that over the last 5 years. A landmark study came out in December and determined that using the risk assessment process had a trivial decrease in the jail population. It increased new crimes while...
We're having a few technical difficulties, but we do have Charisse back on the line with us. And Charisse, I'll ask you the question of, what do you think is wrong with the current system, especially if it's a system that protects the public from someone who's dangerous?
Sure. So you didn't hear me say thanks for having me, but thanks for having me. So I just really want to say that one of the great things about you leading off with that question is that it really helps me directly confront a big myth, which is that the current system does protect the public. So we've heard a lot in the news all across Ohio and across the United States about lots of cases in which people who are simply too poor to post bond and be released are sitting in jail for days or weeks or months, sometimes even well longer than what the law would have been able to sentence them to upon conviction, simply because they can't post a modest amount of money bond, $500, $1,000, something like that. We've heard a lot about that in the news. The reverse of that, though, happens to also be true, which is where individuals who are charged with a serious crime, who may have a lengthy criminal history, have a high dollar amount of a bond set. And those folks are often the ones that are the most attractive to the commercial bail bondsman because the premium on a $200,000 bond is 10%, $20,000, which is a little bit more attractive of a bond to write than a $200 bond. So what we know from research is about half the time people who are charged with those kinds of crimes with high bond amounts, who may have otherwise been detained under a reform system, are actually posting bond and being released pretrial.
Jeff, we got cut off when you were explaining the problems as your organization sees it. So go ahead and pick back up again on that.
Yeah, absolutely. We're having some technical delays today, or technical problems. The state of Kentucky, I think, as a reform jurisdiction, has proven that the reforms don't work.
Right. I should probably back up a little bit, Jeff, and say that prior to you getting cut off, you were saying that Ohio's neighbor to the south, Kentucky, was the example that you were pointing to as a jurisdiction that was having trouble with this. So go right ahead.
Exactly. I mean, they've employed the use of the algorithm for the last 5 years. A landmark study that came out in December basically showed that nothing happened. There weren't radical changes that had really any impact on what's going on. And that's not to say that you can do some bail reform and you could look at some of these lower-level misdemeanors. And really, one of the things we talk about when I go around the country is, if you're going to release somebody anyway, why are you arresting them in the first place? And some of these low-level crimes, they really are nuisance crimes. And as Charisse mentioned, some of them are just ones that commercial bail bondsmen can't serve for various reasons. Either the bonds are just so low that, you can't post a $50 bond because, you can't make any profit or you lose money on it. So I think there are areas for reform, but what we've seen is as these reforms have been implemented nationally, the results just aren't there in the jurisdictions that have gone in this direction.
Charisse, did you want to respond?
Yeah, I'd love to. Hi, Jeff. Nice to be on the radio with you today. I'll first speak to Kentucky and just, say that certainly from our perspective and from published research, which the Law Review article Jeff is referring to in the fall is not peer-reviewed research. Kentucky went under bail reform about 40 years ago when they made writing a bond for profit a felony. And so they haven't had bondsmen in Kentucky for a long time. And about 20 years ago or 15 years ago, they actually moved in the direction of risk assessment. So one of the reasons why there wasn't a dramatic shift in their practice over the last 2 or 3 years has been because they had been using risk assessment before that. So they just really swapped out what they were using for a new tool. But what I really want to draw your listeners' attention to is the example of New Jersey. New Jersey underwent bail reform a couple of years ago. The results published a couple of weeks ago show that in 2017, New Jersey went from releasing some low percentage of people pretrial prior to that to releasing about 95% of people who had been arrested in that year. There have been no increases in the crime rate in New Jersey, and we're looking forward to continuing to see positive results. Kentucky's not the only example. New Jersey's not the only example. There are plenty around the country, and I think that Ohio is in a great position to be debating this issue and deciding what's best for that. But one thing I do just want to add also is that there are some substantial legal issues that Ohio is right to get out ahead in front of. Preset bond schedules, for example, have been challenged in court and have been losing across the country, and the detainment of people simply due to an inability to pay. So for Ohio to get out ahead of this, I think they're in the right direction.
Jeff, what about your thoughts about what's been going on in New Jersey?
Well, the jail population fell more the full year before bail reform than the year after bail reform. And frankly, and Charisse, it's good to be on the radio with you as well. She's a proponent of data, as am I. But we can all agree that the New Jersey court system simply hasn't coughed it up. There's no statistics about new crimes while on bail. There's no statistics about failure to appear on bail. None of it is there, unfortunately. And so for all of us, I think we're all taking a collective deep breath and saying, yeah, what did happen in New Jersey? And the answer is right now, we really don't know. It's a bunch of anecdotes on both sides.
So what are some of the specific problems that your group would point to, Jeff?
Well, we think failures to appear are dramatically up in New Jersey. We don't have any ability to prove that right now. But when talking to law enforcement officials on the ground, they're telling us that nobody's showing up for court. They're telling us that it's a revolving door, a catch-and-release bail system in New Jersey. Unfortunately, we have no way to prove that. So I think the system lacks accountability without the incentive of bail, regardless, you know, like Kentucky, whether it's a cash bond or some financial bond or a bail bondsman. So we think the system lacks accountability at this point.
Charisse, what type of a system would you like to see? Would the Pretrial Justice Institute like to see the elimination of the monetary bail system altogether?
Yeah, so a great example, also just for your listeners, some of the data that Jeff is pointing to, it'd be nice to look just a little bit north in Ohio at Lucas County, which is producing outstanding results. We have a couple of other publications on different jurisdictions across the country where the kinds of data that Jeff and I both agree should be published are actually published. The District of Columbia is another great example. They haven't used money bond in decades. About 95% of people are released pending trial. Over 90% show up for court, and over 90% don't get rearrested pending trial. So I don't have any reason to believe that there's some major crisis in terms of failure to appear in court. I think you would see a lot more of that data coming out if that were to be the case. So we'll wait to see from New Jersey. You know, the best practices in this area, Mark, really are the elimination of financial conditions of release. That's not just money bond set at initial appearance, but it's also the application of pretrial conditions that cause a defendant to have to pay for those. So drug testing or GPS. So the elimination of all financial conditions of release, the use of an assessment tool to help determine what level of supervision might be necessary. Most people don't need much supervision pending trial. And then the monitoring of those folks and the production of good data and results. So we have great models of that across the country.
Charisse, we talk about using a computer algorithm as part of determining whether somebody is low risk or high risk. How reliable are those algorithms?
So you're talking about, and this is sort of, maybe another area where Jeff and I actually agree, given the insurance industry has relied on actuarial science forever. The purpose of actuarial tools is to help make a prediction. It's not a perfect science. You still have human behavior in this. But what we have from research is we've been able to cull down the number of things that actually are predictive of whether or not someone will show up to court or be rearrested pending trial. Not necessarily that individual human, just like my car insurance carrier can't tell exactly if I'm the person that's going to get into a wreck, but they compare me to other people like me and make a prediction. Those tools should be used to determine what's the right level of supervision or monitoring in the community. They're not dispositive, as the representative said, of whether or not someone stays in jail or is released pending trial. In fact, if you are going to detain someone pending trial, you must go through a due process hearing. The risk assessment tool has nothing to do with that. These tools should be tested for their validity. Not only that, but they should also be tested for their impact on disparate impact based on race or gender. So there's a lot of science that goes into that. But there's also, as the representative said, it is one of the things that judges consider at a bail hearing. It is not something that we advocate or anyone else I know advocates for. Replacing judicial discretion.
Yeah, so bail reform is not taking the human element out of it. The judge still has something to say about it. The prosecutor still has something to say.
Actually, we'd like to put the human element back in bail decisions. Right now, when you have a bail schedule, essentially, the only, in many places across the country, the only thing determining whether or not someone gets out of jail is whether or not they have money to hire someone like the folks who work in Jeff's area.
And Jeff, your thoughts on the algorithm that's used in a lot of cases to make these to supply information and background on whether somebody should be released on bail or not.
Well, I think we pay a lot of lip service to say that there's still judicial discretion. The reality is these things are cloaked in science, and you can't have it both ways. They either work or they don't. From my perspective, they're a civil rights disaster, and I give New Jersey as the main example. You have a proprietary algorithm that's protected by a contract. We have no idea how it was constructed. One researcher got behind the curtain and found that of the highest risk cases, only 40% will fail. The problem is the recommendation is made on the entire population. In other words, 6 out of 10 people who are in the high risk categories aren't going to fail to appear and aren't going to commit a new crime. In New Jersey, the algorithm's recommending detention. These are largely unregulated. There's no requirement of absolute transparency. And while we say we want to test them for disparate impact, we haven't done that. And to me, I think it's the Wild West right now with these things. And, I don't think you can have it both ways. They either work or they don't. And I think the jury's out on whether they work or not.
Jeff, what do you think of Ohio, the House Bill 439 that's making its way through the legislature right now?
Well, I think it was probably a more broad attempt than the sponsor wanted to go with, just to get a conversation going. I think the expansion of preventative detention was dangerous. I think the mandatory risk assessment process is going a little bit too far. But I do think it's important to take a look at some of these lower level crimes. And that, as an industry, is something that we're focused on, because I think that's where the real action is. You know, public nuisance crimes and things where, you know, somebody's not eligible for jail as a sentence are things that absolutely should be looked at in Ohio.
Charisse, your thoughts?
So, you know, based on my understanding of what 439 says, Ohio already has an Ohio validated assessment tool, a suite of tools from pretrial all the way through post adjudication. And this is simply extending the requirement that the entire state consider those assessment tools. It doesn't say that you have to use the Ohio tool. You can use any tool you want as long as it's been validated. And it requires the courts to collect data, and it simply eliminates the use of the bail schedule. It does not end money bail in Ohio. It does not standardize the type of assessment tool that has to be used. Unfortunately, the bill does not require the collection of race-based data, but that doesn't mean it actually isn't being collected and couldn't be analyzed. The thing I like about 439 is that it has bipartisan support. I think that's one of the things that the bonding industry is finding challenging right now, is that the groups like the ACLU and the Buckeye Institute in Ohio are pushing for reform. The same was true in many of the other states that we're working in, including, you know, support from places like Right on Crime and R Street Institute. So I think we're seeing really a bipartisan sweep across the country for this reform work. And I think 439 is a really great beginning for this effort in Ohio.
How many states have adopted bail reform so far?
So statewide, this is a county issue, right, for the most part. This is happening at the jail level. And so Kentucky is a statewide system. New Jersey is now a statewide pretrial system, although it does have local control by jails. And so when you say statewide, I would say there's probably 10 states that are in the process of working on this on a statewide basis. We have lots and lots of other jurisdictions, county level jurisdictions that are working on this. I should also say that municipal courts are taking this issue up across the country. As Jeff referenced, there are places where you can end up in jail simply due to a moving violation that's happening in the, at the municipal level. And that's where a lot of the litigation had begun, with detention in, as a result of municipal charges. And so lots and lots of places. We put out a publication that listeners might be interested in called Where Pretrial Reform is Happening. We publish that quarterly, and it's available on our website.
So, Jeff, is there room for improvement in the bail system? I mean, what would be your ideal system from your perspective?
Well, I think, as Cherise said, it's jurisdiction specific. You know, we feel like an increase in individual consideration in bail in general is warranted. I was out in California, and, you know, the law says they have to be heard within 48 hours, and the public defenders universally said that never happens. And so I think, from our perspective, bail is not taken seriously in the criminal justice system, and it needs to be. And so, from our perspective, increases in the amount of individualized consideration is warranted. And then data. In Ohio, this is critical. The Sentencing Commission studied the bail system in Ohio for an entire year. They surveyed 54 jurisdictions. Only 3 kept data on failures to appear. Only 1 kept data on failures to appear new crimes based on the type of release. So I think we need to increase the data collection, particularly in Ohio, so that we can make educated decisions, both state and local level, as to which reforms are needed. Like I said, it's locally driven. In some places, you've got, you know, people being arrested and jailed on extremely low-level crimes. In other places like California, you know, it's a rare day that misdemeanors have to post a bail at all. So it's really locally driven.
Cherise, so what do you think would be the ideal bail system?
Well, you know, as there's lots of local variation in this. The ideal system, from our perspective, has a couple of core values. One, it tries to follow what the law requires, which is that we are required as a country to maximize liberty, maximize release, while maximizing public safety and maximizing appearance in court. One thing I just want to mention in terms of those three M's is that money bond has nothing to do with public safety. You can't be liable for the bond if you commit a new crime. It's simply about appearance in court. And I think what we know from surveying judges across the country is that, and from victims and other groups, is that public safety is paramount. And so we really ought to be looking to see what we can be doing, not to make people worse. So what we know from research as well is that low-risk people who spend time in jail pre-trial, ultimately when they are released, will come out at a higher propensity to commit crime in the future. So we have to be careful that we're not destabilizing people and taking a swipe at public safety. Ideal systems will maximize release, maximize public safety, and maximize appearance in court.
So, Jeff, final thoughts. Sum up for us what your thoughts are on this.
Well, I think this legislation's got a long way to go, and despite the fact that the ACLU and the Buckeye Institute are on board, there's a litany of groups that weren't. The first stakeholder meeting had, you know, 40-some opponents in the room, and I think Ohio is really a locally driven state, from what I can tell, and talking to some of the judges out there, and I think there's real resistance to any effort at the state level. And frankly, I think at a minimum, there's got to be data collection, as I've said. The data in Ohio as to whether there's a problem and the nature of the problem simply doesn't exist. So it's my hope that at a minimum, we can pass something so we can at least get an idea of what's happening in Ohio.
And what about your thoughts on the bail reform movement on the national level? Where is this all headed?
Well, I think it's stabilizing. I think, you know, it was certainly a wave for the last couple of years. I think with the Fifth Circuit ruling last week that preset monetary bail schedules are constitutional if there's adequate due process, has somewhat stabilized things in terms of an immediate need to act because the system's just plain unconstitutional. So I think policymakers are beginning to get a little bit smarter on this issue and starting to ask some hard questions. And I think in terms of going to a no-money bail system, I think that idea is starting to wane a little bit.
And Cherise, would you agree with Jeff that things are stabilizing?
Oh, I think they're stabilizing, but in a different direction than Jeff is referencing. Our experience has been across the country that this is a bit of a runaway train, and I think this is part of the reason why you see folks like Beth Chapman and others, who and Dog the Bounty Hunter, who are trying to defend the bail bonding industry. really pulling out all the stops. This has been referred to as the death toll, the death knoll for bail bonding. So I think the days of money bond are numbered. I think that there is a wave moving across this country that will be very, very difficult to stop. And it's not really just about bail reform. This is really about criminal justice reform as a whole. I think with 450,000 people each year who are in jail simply because they can't post bond in a pretrial status, I think that's really caught the ear of many, many people. And this notion that the vast majority of people who are experiencing mass incarceration on any given day are actually unconvicted people is part of a larger conversation about criminal justice reform. So we look forward to continuing in that. And, we're a pretty persistent organization. We have a large coalition of supporters from judges to prosecutors to cops to defense attorneys, county commissioners, state legislative folks. So I think this is really on its way to being a very, very successful reform across the country.
Charisse, thank you so much for joining us today. And Jeff, thank you as well.
Thank you.
Executive Director of the American Bail Coalition, Jeff Clayton, and CEO of the Pretrial Justice Institute, Charisse Burdine. Thanks for listening to this podcast of Cincinnati Edition. The producer was Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer was Selena Reeder. Josh Elstro was the technical director. I'm Mark Haney.